Hi again, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to the Cleveland Public Library's Sports Research Department. Today is April 13th, 2015, and our guest today is Mike Cleary, who has spent virtually his entire life in college athletics. For the last many years, the director of the College Athletic Directors Association. Mike is a native Clevelander, went to St. Ignatius High School, John Carroll University. And Mike, let's start at the beginning with you. And then, by the way, we're going to get into the stories of Mike and George Steinbrenner. Mike was the first person Steinbrenner ever fired. He was the general manager of a pro basketball team in Cleveland. And then he wound up putting together became the first director of the College Athletic Directors Association. All of this, we're going to get to that. But let's begin at the beginning with you. How did you get into sports?
Well, I guess my interest was peaked when I was a kid. I lived right near Shaw High School, and Cleveland Rams played some home games there. They played between League Park and Shaw. And so I sold popcorn over there, and I got interested in following the Rams, who ended up being the NFL champions in 1945.
Was this during the war, World War II?
Yeah, it was like 1943, 4, 5.
So a National Football League team played
Shaw High School Stadium.
Shaw Stadium. Wow.
Yeah. In fact, someone in the old Ask Hal thing asked Hal about that, said someone told him that, and Hal said, yeah, I was there.
Really?
Yeah. But anyhow.
And what kind of crowds were they drawing then, the Cleveland Rams? What, 4,000?
No, they'd fill Shaw. Then they'd draw 20,000 at League Park. And then when they played the NFL championship game in 45, they played the stadium, probably had like 32 or something like that. But from there, when I went to Ignatius, unfortunately, a classmate of mine was working in the visiting team clubhouse for the Indians. So he had a buddy of his that he brought in. The buddy, for some reason, didn't like the job, and so he asked me if I was interested. So I went down. So I ended up in the clubhouse. I worked there in 49-50.
Really?
And, I mean, I can remember sitting in the dugout next to Connie Mack.
Really?
You know, and he was Mr. Mack in his suit. And I can remember there was a game towards the end of the season. There was a pitcher named Lou Brissy.
Yeah.
Who was a Canadian RAF war hero who was shot in the leg and had a... it wasn't a prosthetic, but he had some kind of a.
He wore a brace on his leg,
brace,
didn't he?
Yeah, and but he was pitching and you know he made it back to the major leagues after the war, but he was getting shelled this day by the Indians, and Connie Mack said to the pitching coach, "Go pull him," and so Brissy comes off and Connie Mack nods to him. He says, Mr. Brissy, come over here. And Brissy comes over. He said, you've just pitched your last game for the Philadelphia Athletics.
Really?
Yeah. And that was his style. That was how he was.
Wow.
Yeah. But so
and then, by the way, he wound up pitching for the Indians.
Yeah.
1951 or so, maybe the next year.
Yeah.
And he had a terrible outing one day, walked the bases loaded, and Bob Neal was doing the game on the radio. And he said, guy who can't get the ball over the plate doesn't belong in the major leagues. Oh, all hell broke loose in this town. How can you say that about a war hero who pitched with a brace on his leg?
Yeah. That was
yes.
So that was my kid stuff.
Yes.
And then after I got out of Carroll, I went in the Navy for a couple of years, and then came back and started with Ed Sweeney to put together a team to see if Cleveland would support a NIBL team.
Now this is interesting. You just get out of the Navy. Your previous experience had been you had been the sports information director at John Carroll.
Right.
Now, so you had that in your background.
My 3 years, yeah.
3 years, the sports information director, while you were a student at John Carroll.
Yeah, they had. I was a student sports information director my freshman year, and the guy quit during the year, and they were going to hire another full-time guy. And I went to Father Mooney, and I said, "Father, you don't have to hire." I said, "I can handle this." And he said, "Well, how are you going to handle this in your schoolwork?" I said, "Well, we'll work it out." You know, long story short, the schoolwork suffered a little, but I did get the job done and had it for 3 years. And in those days, Carroll was, you know, they were playing like a Mid-America Conference schedule. I mean, we played Kent, Akron, Bowling Green, Toledo, St. Bonaventure, Detroit, Marshall. Bradley, and that was the
football schedule.
Basketball schedule was Seton Hall, St. Francis of Pennsylvania with Maurice Stokes, you know, Iona. So they were playing pretty good schedule because it was a full scholarship program.
Yes,
and that lasted until 52, when they decided to. Strip the scholarships and make it a Division III program, which it has been since then. And I give them credit for at least keeping football. Xavier was in the same position, and Xavier opted to drop football totally. And Carroll decided to keep it. And I think it was the right move for them. When you see all of the people that they have in the National Football League now, I mean, offensive coordinator for the Patriots, the offensive coordinator for the Buffalo Bills, the general manager of Jacksonville, the general manager of San Diego. I mean, that's amazing.
They all went to John Carroll.
They all went to John Carroll.
Gee.
And there's about another 14 guys in the in front offices in the NFL from Carroll.
Wow.
They have ex-coaches who have coached in the NFL. There's 23 Super Bowl rings.
Really?
From Carroll, yeah.
Gee.
Of course, you go back to Don Shula.
Yeah.
I mean, he had a pretty good tradition.
Yes.
He had Carl Tassif on his staff.
Oh,
he had Silker Nagyon on his staff.
Mm.
So he had Clevelanders, you know, with him at the time.
So now you have this background. You get out of the Navy. Were you looking specifically to get back into a full-time job in sports? And is that how you wound up hooking up with Ed Sweeney?
Yeah, I really was. Uh-huh. And I had this idea that we could put a basketball team together and compete at the NIBL level.
NIBL was the National Industrial Basketball League. That was part of the AAU.
And that was the old Phillips Oilers, the Peoria Caterpillars, and Akron Goodyear.
Yeah.
And it was where the U.S. Olympic team came from in those days.
Yes.
I mean, you always had the winner of the AAU tournament had six players that went. And then they pick six others from within the league. So you might have one or two college kids that made the team at the most, and you'd have 10 to 12 NIBL players. You know, there was only eight teams in the NBA. If you weren't drafted in the first round, you weren't going to play.
Yeah.
You just didn't make it. You know, the players hung on for a long time. But and it was a Lily White League, and so we hired John McClendon, who had just won three championships, three NAIA championships in 57, 58, and 59, and we hired him to come to Cleveland, and he was the first African-American to be the coach of a team above the collegiate level.
Now, this would have been the 1959-60
season.
You played at the arena.
Right.
You mentioned that you had a meeting with the people from the three newspapers in Cleveland at the time.
We met with the three sports editors.
Okay.
At the time, there was the Press, the News, and the Plain Dealer.
Uh-huh.
we had a luncheon at the Cleveland Athletic Club. Uh-huh. Ed told him what he was planning to do.
Ed Sweeney, who was the founder of the team.
Right,
yes.
And asked what their opinion was. Yeah. And they said, no, well, Cleveland's not ready for a black coach.
Really?
Yeah.
So you hired John McClendon anyway.
Yes, we did.
And he turned out to be a great coach.
And he ended up also breaking another barrier later in his career when he became the first African-American coach to coach a primary white school when he went to Cleveland State.
Okay, yes. Okay, now, Ed Sweeney was a Cleveland guy. I believe he went to Cathedral Latin as a, back in his school days. He's long dead now. But he had a plumbing company. That's why they called his team the Cleveland Pipers.
Yeah, it was,
because he was had a plumbing company.
A piping company, heating and air conditioning, you know. And so the piping was the theme. So that's why we named him the Pipers.
Okay. And he was a big sports fan. Also was the ring announcer for boxing shows here.
Yeah, big boxing fan.
Yes. Nice guy, Ed. Also had very interested in boxing, but now it's basketball. And he starts this team. And how does it go from Ed Sweeney owning this team to George Steinbrenner?
Well, in about the middle of the second year, Ed saw he was in over his head. And
running out of money.
Running out of money, and his family, really forced him to get rid of the team. Mm-hmm. He didn't have anything to sell. George just came in and took the assets. Mm-hmm. George wasn't a McClendon fan from the beginning,
really?
But he assumed his 3-year contract. I think it was a year and a half left.
And he assumed also inherited you, the general manager.
Right. And it was George and a bunch of young, wealthy Cleveland kids his age. I was a 24-year-old general manager, and he was a 29-year-old owner at the time. So that's that was the difference. But it was Jim Stouffer and people like that. That were on the committee.
Okay, and so we're now. Are you going to tell us how it was that he fired you? As well, build this up. It's your story. I'm going to stop interrupting you.
Well, we went through the league. We won the AAU championship. It was an all white league. Mm-hmm. And we came in with a black coach and six black players.
Wow.
And we didn't do John any favors on the white players we had because they were from Kentucky, Tennessee, Western Kentucky, Moorhead, Eastern Kentucky, and one from Illinois. So we're five from below the Mason-Dixon line. And we, on the road, we roomed, we made sure that that the blacks and whites roomed together.
Really?
Yeah. And it was, we never had a problem.
So this worked out okay.
That's never had a problem. And then when we were, Abe Saperstein started the American Basketball League, George jumped into the American Basketball League.
So George took the Pipers. They were still called the Pipers, weren't they?
Yeah.
And so he took them from the National Industrial League into this new ABL.
Right.
And a rival to the NBA now.
Right. And it was Abe Saperstein put the league together. Mm-hmm. And
Abe, of course, was the
head of the Globetrotters.
Right, founded the Globetrotters.
And, part of the deal was, you'd get the Globetrotters would play a doubleheader with you maybe two or three times a year with each team in the league. Uh-huh. So that's that worked out very well. But when we went into the league, we had I don't know there was still there was, we still had predominantly, you know, we were more black than white. Mm-hmm. And
were any other players? Were the other teams integrated in the league at that time?
In the Industrial League, none.
Yeah.
But once we got in the ABL, yes. Then mm-hmm. there were some players mm-hmm. come over. In fact, Connie Hawkins played in the league, and mm-hmm. you know, people that went on to the mm-hmm. NBA. In fact, when the league folded, which was midway through the third season, mm-hmm. 11 players went to the NBA, and I'd signed 10 of them, 5 from Cleveland and 5 from Kansas uh-huh. City. Because when I got fired by George, I ended up in Kansas City as the general manager.
Okay. So, why did George fire you?
Well, we had a deal where we were going to bring in Dick Barnett, was going to jump from the NBA mm-hmm. to the ABL, which was a big story.
Who was Dick playing with at that time?
Dick was playing with the Rochester Royals.
Uh-huh.
The deal was in those days, as you're aware, you know, you had the three newspapers and you had AM and PM releases, mm-hmm. and the three newspapers honored that, mm-hmm. and so it was a PM turn, so the press had decided they were going to do a big story on this, so Bob August had the story. It was going to be a front page story. So the night before the story is supposed to break, Gib Shanley is his first night in town. And he's at Hiram down at the uh-huh. Browns camp. And he sees it come over the wire. Uh-huh. And he puts it on the 11 o'clock news. So Chuck Heaton.
Not knowing, of course, that there was this was a release.
Right. He had no uh-huh. clue because he was brand new in town. So Chuck Heaton calls me about 11 o'clock.
He was the plane dealer writer.
And he calls me and said, Mike, he said, you know, we got to put something in the paper in the morning. He mm-hmm. said, it's not going to get much. You're going to get about three lines, uh-huh. you know. And that's what we got. And the press said, well, you know, we got nothing. Uh-huh. So we got nothing out of the uh-huh. press. So George went bananas. So you know, I go in the morning, and uh-huh. he comes in, and he's screaming, and I'm screaming. It's you're fired, I quit, you know, one of those deals. And so next thing, I'm out the door. So it was funny, about 2 weeks before the league meeting, mm-hmm. the guy from Kansas City comes up to me and said, you know, we haven't hired a general manager yet. Do you think you'd have any interest in coming to Kansas uh-huh. City? I said, I live in Cleveland all my life. I don't think so. So all of a sudden, I dig out his business card and give him a call. I laid it out. I told him what happened. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, if you still want to come, he said, we'll bring you out. So I was married. I had two little kids. And we go out to Kansas City. And I must have had three kids at the time. And we ended up, we go out to Kansas City, and we had a great time. It was a great, stayed out there 6 years. The league folded after a year, and I had made connections with the NAIA headquarters were there, mm-hmm. the NCAA headquarters were there. Mm-hmm. So I'd been familiar with the NAIA tournament through mm-hmm. McClendon through the years, so when the league folded, the executive director of the NAIA asked me if I would have any interest in coming and running the tournament. I said, sure. So it was a 32-team tournament. It ran for a week. It was, you know, it was a lot of
fun.
Out
in Kansas City, usually, right?
Kansas City, yeah.
But NAIA, of course, that was another.
That was.
Yeah, you think of, they've got the NCAA today, and you've also got the NAIA.
Right.
Separate.
Right.
Yeah.
But those were the smaller schools. Mm-hmm. But in those days, those were also all of the historically black schools. You had Grambling, you had Jackson State, you had all those people in the NAI. The NAI had 650 schools.
Wow.
They now have about 190.
Mm-hmm.
But and so I stayed there for a year, and then the NCAA hired me as their first director of meets and tournaments. They never had anybody to run the Final Four and stuff like that. I mean, I can remember calling Al McGuire to inviting Marquette, and he said, let me call you back tomorrow. I said, I'm going to see if the NIT calls tonight.
Really?
I mean, that's how important the NCAA tournament was in those days. We had 11 total people. When I went to the NCAA, we had 11 people.
Working. The entire
male
office?
And female. I mean, secretaries, everybody. That
really?
Was it. That was it. We had 11 people. And now they have 550 people, 120 in enforcement. They're all attorneys.
Wow.
So
enforcement.
Yeah.
Looking for the rule breakers.
Yeah,
put you on probation.
Things have changed.
Now, let us digress briefly from where you are in your career with the NCAA. Back to George Steinbrenner here in Cleveland. The league that Saperstein started, that the Cleveland Pipers were in, the league folded in midseason.
Right.
Now, Steinbrenner's Cleveland franchise was invited to enter the NBA at that time.
Right.
Now, would you finish that story? Why Cleveland did not wind up going into the NBA back in, what, 1962?
Well,
we should have been in the NBA way back then.
We had made a deal, and George was hiring me back.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was going to be the general manager.
In the NBA.
Right. And the deal was that we were the Cleveland Pipers could keep all of their players.
Mm-hmm.
They could take whatever players they wanted from Kansas City. Those two teams who had played for the championship.
Mm-hmm.
They would get a territorial first round draft choice of Jerry Lucas.
Wow.
Guaranteed.
Uh-huh.
And they were scheduled, they were penciled in to schedule to open the season in Madison Square Garden against the Knicks.
Wow.
And
Cleveland
was. George had gone and brokered a deal with Maurice Podoloff, who was the commissioner of the NBA at the time, and came back and said, it's done. His partner was going to be the guy that owned the San Francisco franchise in our league. So all of a sudden, you know, it came time for to pony up with the money.
And how much money was involved?
Probably, I think, I want to say that $500,000. And George had ponied up his $250,000, and the other guy couldn't come up with the money.
Really?
And that was, pulled the plug.
Wow.
That was it.
Didn't George go to his father asking him for a loan?
Well, He may have. I don't know. His father was pretty fed up with basketball by that time. I mean, his father, when I was here, his father would call me at home at night and say, hey, how much do we owe Rube Adlers? How much do we owe?
Rube Adlers, he was the uniform guy, right?
He said.
Down on Detroit Avenue.
Yeah. And, you know, he said, George's nickel.
A little sporting goods store.
Nickel and diamond me, he said. He's nuts in the basketball business, you know. I'd say to him, Mr. Steinbrenner, you know, I really know what to tell you. And he said, well, you better come with some answers, you know. Your paycheck's coming from me, not from George, you know. And I can remember going up to George's office once, and he had a telephone that he had under his desk, and it didn't ring. But a light shined when it came on. So that was a phone he used for personal calls. So while I'm there,
that was also his basketball line too.
Yeah,
basketball phone.
So when I happened to be
wait now, George was working for his father in the shipbuilding company,
was,
right?
American Shipbuilding.
Yes,
and in Kinsman Transit, who owned 8 oar boats.
Uh-huh.
That was their primary business,
uh-huh.
and they were just really starting American shipbuilding. So I'm up there. We both had offices in the Rockefeller Building, okay. and I want to say Kinsman Transit was like on the sixth floor, and we were on the third floor. Uh-huh. So George would call me and say, "Come on up," you know. So I'd come up about 4 o'clock, and all of a sudden his father walks in, and he said to me, he says, "Go out there and sit down, out there." He said, "George and I have some business." He said, "He's mine till 5 o'clock." He said, and so I go out, and there's this old lady out there, and she's got the
she's like advisor. The receptionist.
Well, no, she was like the bookkeeper.
Oh.
So I'm trying to make conversation with her, and I said, "Boy," I said, "George is really something, isn't he?" She says, "Yep." And I said, "And Henry, his father, I said, "And Henry, he's really something." She said, "Yep." She said, "Sonny, you should have met Henry's father.
Oh.
He was really something." So she'd been there for three generations.
Gee.
So she'd seen them all.
Oh. So that's why then the deal fell through. Yep. Cleveland did not go into the NBA then.
The guy didn't come up with the money. George had his money.
Yeah, did he?
But the other guy didn't.
I'll be darned. So anyway, Cleveland had to wait then until 1970 to get the expansion Cavaliers.
Yeah.
So now we return to you. You're in Kansas City working for the NAIA. Then you just switched to the NCAA.
Yeah, I worked for the NAIA 1 year and then went out of the NCAA.
And because both were headquartered in Kansas City,
right?
Conveniently for you.
Well, you know, it was funny. In Kansas City, in those days, they had the Big 8, which is now the Big 12. Mm-hmm. Missouri Valley Conference was there. The NCAA, the NAIA, the Fellowship of Christian Athletes.
Really?
I mean, it was the hub of collegiate athletics.
Wow. And so back then you were one of what, 11 employees, did you say?
Yeah, 11. Yeah.
And at that time both the NCAA and the NIT were both invitationals.
Yeah.
Of course, NIT stands for National Invitational Tournament.
Right.
NCAA, the colleges decided to start their own.
Right.
Did the gambling scandals in New York City at the NIT have anything to do with that?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
No, the NCAA had started their tournaments before, but it wasn't on the public radar,
okay.
You know. I mean, the first championship was held at Northwestern University.
Really?
Yeah. And when I was there in the early years, it rotated between Kansas City and Louisville.
Really?
Basically. I mean, it didn't expand. There was no television.
Mm-hmm.
There was no television at all. If UCLA came in and they had local TV back to LA, but there was no national TV.
Okay. And so you were with them until you watched it grow.
Well, I was at the NCAA and the athletic directors had decided that, you know, there's an organization called American Baseball Coaches Association, National Association of Basketball Coaches, okay. American Football Coaches Association.
Yeah, yeah.
All the coaches had an association. They didn't.
The athletic directors did not.
Yeah, and they said, you know, we come to the NCAA convention and we're so bogged down by rules and regulations, we don't have time to schedule, we don't have time to socialize, we don't have time to do anything. Why don't we start our own organization and have our meetings in the summer? Mm-hmm. When we can, you know, let our hair down and mm-hmm. get a few things done in comfortable settings.
Mm-hmm.
So a guy named Jim Corbett, who was the athletic director at LSU and also was the NCAA's television liaison, he put it together and called the office one day, and he was asking for Walter Byers, mm-hmm. who was – and it was around lunchtime.
Byers was the director.
Byers was executive director.
Of the NCAA.
NCAA.
Yes.
So I ended up, I mean, there was nothing, but there was only 11 of us, and mm-hmm. phone rang, you answered it, you know. So I answered the phone, mm-hmm. and Jim Corbett said, explained to me what they were doing, and the athletic directors were going to have this meeting, and they were going to get together and what he was
and really, form their own association.
Right, and what he was really calling Walter about was, did Walter have any young guy that he could mm-hmm. recommend to be their executive director and get him off the ground? Mm-hmm. And I said, Jim, I got just the guy for you. And he said, who's that? I said, me. And so he was a hard guy to pin down.
Who, Jim down at LSU?
Oh, yeah. And so we went back and forth on the phone a couple times, and he assured me that, you know, that they checked my credentials and everything, and that he thought I could do the job. So I'm trying to get with him. Mm-hmm. So my secretary calls his secretary to find out they're opening the season, I think, at Rice. And they're going to fly from New Orleans over to Houston.
Then now this is Jim Corbett's LSU team.
Right. So
LSU football team.
So I have she calls, and she books me a seat on their plane, and gets me a seat next to him. Uh-huh. So I've got him now for a couple hours. Uh-huh. So when we were done, it was a done deal. Uh-huh. So that was how I wrapped it up.
Okay, and that was what year now that you started this?
Well, 1965.
Okay.
This is our 50th year.
Okay.
In June yes. will be our 50th year.
So the Athletic Directors Association started with how many schools?
We have 311 schools came to the first meeting, and 300 came to the first convention.
Okay. And now you have a convention every year. How many schools?
We have 1,650 schools.
Wow.
And we have about almost 11,000 members.
Wow.
And our exhibits the first year, mm-hmm. I sold 11 tabletops at $300 a piece. Uh-huh. Got stiffed on about two of them. And this year we will have over 300 booths at $3,000 a piece.
Wow. Booths at this convention.
Yeah.
So now these are vendors.
Yeah. So I mean, our exhibit area is $1 million
wow.
dollars.
Wow. Gee.
Yeah.
And now, what does the Athletic Directors Organization do?
Well, do you affect
change or anything like that?
Yeah, we're lobbyists without being mm-hmm. lobbyists. You know, we lobby within the structure of intercollegiate athletics. Sometimes, you know, if there's a something, you know, going through Congress or the Senate, you know, when we need some stiff iron, we'll call a guy from the representative's area and get that done. We put out a magazine. We run clinics, different kind of mm-hmm. clinics. We run clinics on insurance. We run clinics on what to do in the future. With your disposable income and things of that nature. We run all kinds of clinics.
Anyway, your office is what you always wanted, right? You were still back home.
Yeah.
Your office is on Detroit Road in Westlake.
Yep.
This is the headquarters of the college athletic directors right here in Westlake, Ohio.
Well, we run under the radar. I mean, like in the 80s and 90s, we ran the kickoff classic.
I remember that.
In New York City.
Mm-hmm.
We ran 20 of those. We ran 13 kickoff classics.
Uh-huh.
Which was sometimes would be 2 days apart. One would be on a Sunday, one would be on a Monday night.
One in the East, one in the West?
Yeah.
Really?
And so we ran.
National television?
We ran, national.
Usually you'd have the defending national champion in one of the games, didn't you?
So we had 33 bowl games we ran out of our little office in Westlake, and no one even knew we were there.
Wow.
I mean, Plain Dealer still doesn't know we're here.
Well, You started it. How many employees do you have in your little office in Westlake now?
We have 14. And of the 14, 7 are ex-interns.
Really?
Yeah, we have interns all over the country.
Wow.
Yeah. Lee Reed, who's the AD at Georgetown, was a former intern.
Ah. Well, didn't you also have a relationship with the New York Knicks? You told me this many, many, many years ago. And I don't know if you can talk publicly about this.
Yeah, part of it, I can. Yeah. not the part you were referring to.
Oh, I don't know what I was referring to.
I do. when the league folded,
yeah.
and the Knicks found out that I had signed 10 of the 11 players and went in the NBA, Ned Irish hired me.
Uh-huh.
And he asked me to be a scout for him for a couple of years. So while I had this other job, I double dipped. In fact, I have a 69-70 Knicks ring,
wow.
Championship ring, which Mr. Irish gave to me.
Gee,
yeah.
So you scouted for the Knicks.
And my first guy was Phil Jackson.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. And they were eternally grateful.
Yeah, yeah. And to this day, he doesn't know that.
Phil doesn't?
No, he hasn't a clue because, I mean, I would
that
go over.
That you recommended him?
Yeah, I would go over. Our offices were in Minneapolis at the time. We had moved from Kansas City to Minneapolis with the athletic directors, and he was at North Dakota State. And I would fly over there on a Saturday and watch a game. I did that about 3 times.
Really?
Talked to Red Holzman, who was there. Red was not the coach at the time. Red was the chief scout. And Eddie Donovan was the coach.
Oh, yeah.
And Dick McGuire was Al's brother, was the scout with them. And I would recommend to Al through Red that I thought that's who they ought to take in the second round.
Wow.
So they worked. It worked.
Gee. Now, you're 80 years old now.
Yep.
And now you have started a program at John Carroll University, a story about it here in the John Carroll Alumni Magazine. Would you tell us about this?
Yeah, well, I started my career at Carroll, really. I mean, the student sports information director, that's where I really got to know. I worked very closely. I had a great relationship with the plain dealer guys, the news guys, the press guys. I loved, in those days, you went down, you took hard copy and you tried to sell a story, And it was fun, You got to know Bob August and Chuck Heaton and Shel Fullerton and guys like that. That's where I really cut my teeth. So I decided that I've had a nice career and a nice legacy would be to talk to Carroll about starting a sports information or sports studies program. Mm-hmm. And we put it together. It's there's Dr. Kathleen Manning is in charge of it, and this is the first full year of it. And the admissions office told me that they have 55 declared majors coming in this year. So that's great. Great news to hear that.
And this is training to become a sports executive?
Yes, yes. And as I say, we've got so many guys in the NFL that we can bring in to speak.
Wow.
There's an awful lot of talent. Bill Polian, he had 3 sons that played football at Carroll.
No kidding.
Yeah. And he's going in the Football Hall of Fame this August.
So not only do you have all of these people running pro sports teams, but they are potential employers of many of your graduates.
Yeah,
then.
And also will assist in internships and mentorships, mm-hmm. and you know, things of that nature, mm-hmm. while they're attending school.
This is becoming a big thing in colleges, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
I remember Ohio University was one of the first.
Yeah. It started a school called Biscayne College, which is now St. Thomas, was the first one down in Florida, mm-hmm. and that started about 1962 or 63, mm-hmm. I'd say. There's over 320 schools now that have as a major.
Wow.
Now, Ohio U, their master's program is like the Harvard.
Really?
I mean, they have several general managers. They have athletic directors. As we talked at lunch, they've got like 30-some executives in Japanese baseball.
Wow.
I mean, it's amazing. Their tentacles are all over the place.
Wow. Well, Mike, I appreciate the time you've spent with us today, and I'm sure that anyone listening to this has been certainly informed. Mike Clary, thank you very much for telling us about not only your life in sports, but all of the things that you've seen happen here in Cleveland. You were part of so much of it.
Well, you know, the first NBA game was Cleveland Rebels.
Okay, 1946.
Yeah.
In the end, oh, that's right. That's we were actually the in the NBA right. in 1946.
Yeah, for a year.
Yes. 1 year,
yeah.
Yes.
And then I saw the first Cavs game. Uh-huh. I saw the last Rams game. Uh-huh. Saw the first Browns game.
Gee.
Saw the last stadium game.
Wow.
Saw the last Indians game at League Park.
Really?
So, you know, seen a lot.
Wow. Was League Park a cozy place?
It was great. It was a reverse Fenway.
Really?
You know, you had the big wall in the right field.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
And Keltner, you know, when he came up.
Third baseman Kenny Keltner.
He was, you know, he's a big, strong guy, a pull hitter. He learned to go the other way, and he popped, you know, 20-some home runs playing at Lake Park.
Did he? Over the right field wall.
Yeah, in the right field. In those days, when Vec bought the team, they were still at League Park.
Mm-hmm.
And so Vec...
League Park at 66th and Lexington.
Yeah, 66th and Lexington. Mm-hmm. And then Vec slowly moved them. They started mm-hmm. his first year playing weekends at the stadium mm-hmm. and weekdays at League mm-hmm. Park. And then the next year, everything went to the stadium. That was probably 48, probably his first year. Maybe 47.
47, I think.
47.
He played the entire season
right.
at the stadium.
Right.
Yes.
But 46, I think, was back and forth, you know.
Yes. I regret that I missed by, a year and a half seeing a game at League Park.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I used to go to the Cleveland Buckeyes game there.
Did you really?
Yeah. I mean, it was you didn't feel there was no intimidation or anything. It was,
now, where you grew up there in East Cleveland, how would you get to League Park? Would you ride your bike? Would you take a trolley or what?
Take a streetcar down Euclid Avenue and just walk down from 66th Street.
Uh-huh.
You know, walk down to Lexington. It was like three blocks.
Uh-huh. Wow. Well, Mike, hope you see many more events here. Did you see any of the World Series games of 1948?
Saw all the home games, yeah.
Did you really?
Yeah. And 54, unfortunately.
Yes. Uh-huh. Okay. Mike Clary, everybody. What a career he's had and what an impact he had on Cleveland sports. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.